Southern politicians of that era.
So they were sort of isolationists.
Yes, many were proto-isolationists. You know, they disagreed about what America should do. I mean, you know, it's not as if the United States, the simple answer would be to just withdraw from international affairs. I mean, there's legitimate humanitarian crises and political instability and all the economic volatility that comes with those things in the Caribbean in this period. And, you know, something has to be done. And the anti-imperialists really don't have an answer to what should be done, which is really a big part of their problem. They just know what they don't want to do. And they don't want to become a European-style colonial power. They don't want to send boots on the ground. They don't want to get into the business of managing economies or political systems of foreign peoples that don't share America's constitutional traditions. And I'm paraphrasing what the anti-imperialists would say.
Now, fast forwarding, John Kerry announcing, I think he announced, I don't have a quote, in November 2013 that the era of the Monroe Doctrine was over.
Yes, he did.
And then, you know, Trump and John Bolton re-enunciate the Monroe Doctrine.
Yes, they do. And if your listeners have been following the Republican presidential primary, you know, DeSantis, Ramaswamy, Mike Pence, they all gave, when they gave, they're kind of like, okay, here's my little speech about foreign affairs, you know, for my campaign launch. They all said that their foreign policies would be guided by the Monroe Doctrine. And indeed, just a couple weeks ago, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a group of Republicans, drafted a resolution declaring their fidelity to this old symbol from the days of sailing ships and flintlock muskets and monarchs. So it's definitely made a comeback on the American right. And on the American left, you're not going to hear much about it. And if you do, it's going to be like what John Kerry said, and that was the era of the Monroe Doctrine is over.
And all these individuals, all these politicians, they actually cite the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what is going on? Like, that might be the first question. Like, what's going on here? And we should just say that, first point, the history of the Monroe Doctrine, it has this like jack-in-the-box quality. Like, it jumps out in particular moments of time. It frames public debate. And then it just kind of crawls back into its box and no one hears about it for another 20 years. So it's not unusual in the 200-year sweep for this to happen. And of course, the doctrine really hasn't been invoked, at least in the scale that it is right now, since probably the Cuban Missile Crisis, maybe during some of Ronald Reagan's Central American policies in the 1980s, there's some Monroe Doctrine talk. But it really has been 20, 30, 40 years since we've seen this. But that's not unusual. So that's point number one. Point number two, so obvious, our metastasizing culture wars are just always in search of new fodder. And I think one way to understand the revival of the Monroe Doctrine is that it's just a fresh source of fuel for the inferno of our culture wars. And so if John F. Kerry says the Monroe Doctrine is over, and of course, when he says that, he's talking to the Organization of American States, okay? He's seeking to curry favor with them, with the Latin American delegates. For them, as you've alluded, the Monroe Doctrine, it's totally, totally toxic. It's linked not to celebrations of democratic government. It is linked to, you know, a century plus project of Yankee imperialism. So, you know, Kerry's, it's not a bad move to curry favor with, you know, your partners at a big conference. And that's what Kerry was doing. And of course, for him, you know, an old kind of symbol from, you know, has racist, imperialistic undertones, like, it's good politics to back away from that. I mean, that's what the left is doing in general with old historical symbols and statues and so forth. So that's what Kerry's doing. You know, it's because Kerry said that, I think, that the American right seizes and latches on to the Monroe Doctrine. You know, this is another revered nationalist tradition that the American left is attempting to cancel. You know, that would be one way of reading why the right is interested in the Monroe Doctrine. But I think that there's one more important aspect to this, David. And that is, if you look at the, especially in the Republican primary this year, if you look at those that are most vocally endorsing the doctrine, and that would be DeSantis and Ramaswamy, they are also the ones calling for a retrenchment in American global policy. You know, they don't want the United States to spread itself around the globe. They're opposed in varying degrees, opposed to arming Ukraine and supporting Ukraine. They want the United States to pull back, and they want the United States to focus more on, say, the southern border and the border wall, and they want American resources to be invested at home. They look, in other words, kind of like the 1930s Monroe Doctrine advocates on the isolationist end of the political spectrum. And what the doctrine does for them is it enables them to present this new policy. And it would be a retreat from America's global commitment since 1945. It enables them to present it as part of a much longer American tradition, and also as a manly, assertive American tradition. And we know that that's important to someone like DeSantis and Ramaswamy. They don't want to be depicted as isolationists that are afraid of standing up to foreign aggression. But in the Monroe Doctrine, they can have it both ways. They can pursue the policy that they want, and they can present themselves as manly, and the Republican Party as the real party of America's national interest. So I think that's what's going on here with the Monroe Doctrine's revival today.
What I've always found interesting is how things that happened, events 200 years gone, still have potency. They still have the power to animate. And I recall back in 2015, I was in France, in the south of France, watching television. This is the time of the anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo. And you actually had three commentators on national French television debating. I think there was an English historian in there and a French historian debating who won the Battle of Waterloo while the battle was actually being reenacted on the fields of Flanders, you know, on television by all these people, these fans of historical reenactment. And they were actually debating who actually won the Battle of Waterloo. And when I first went to Canada, moved up to Canada in 1971, and I was an American, and I remember people asking me, who won the War of 1812? Because, of course, the Canadians think they won the War of 1812. And I would say, why? You know, I understood. I'd say, why? The Americans won the War of 1812. And they'd all, the whole room would erupt. So it's interesting that events 200 years ago, they still animate. They're still a source of fervor and debate, sometimes acrimonious, which I find something really interesting about history. So how about, like, reflecting on that? Do you discuss this with your own students, the Monroe Doctrine, and does it animate? Does it get students interested? Do they debate? Do they see relevance today?
I think that they do, and I think that they see more relevance. It's easier now when they can, you know, pick up the paper or read the digital paper, I suppose, and see that this is a live thing again, and it's not something just from days gone by. The key point really is how these events or the historical things that we memorialize and we make part of our kind of popular discourse for years and years and years at a time. The important thing is to just say, well, why does that happen? What gives these things traction? And I think it's really important for these events and why they're remembered to understand how important, like, education is, and not like college students, but like grade school students. You pick up any textbook and the Monroe Doctrine is in there. Kids have, you know, they take their high school exams. It's in there. That's probably most people's association with the Monroe Doctrine is from the high school textbooks. And if you look at those textbooks, they're still almost all following the script of how American history was presented in the days of the Cold War. There's exceptions. I mean, I think you'll have a lot more on slavery now than you would have 50 years ago. But still, America's self-understanding is linked to the Cold War. And, you know, that's only just in the last 5-10 years really begun to be challenged and started to unravel. That is why education and textbooks are emerging as such a hot button political issue, particularly at the states. I mean, again, look at DeSantis. Florida high school curricula standards were revised. If you look at what he wants students to know about the United States, it's like going back into a time warp and reading a Cold War era textbook. And the Monroe Doctrine, incidentally, is part of the new Florida education standards. So I guess what I'm coming back to you with here is these events are remembered, but they're contested, they're politicized. And the nature of that contestation evolves and changes over time in ways so that the original event itself has got almost nothing to do with what's being debated today. I mean, I'd be curious that Waterloo discussion and debate among the French and British historians, like how much of that was actually about the Battle of Waterloo versus how much was that about, at that moment in time, the possibility of Brexit, which we know would have just happened a few years later, about French and German leadership of the European Union, with the British feeling like they were somehow elbowed out. I would rather suspect that that's what accounts for how they were debating Waterloo more than the actual battle itself.
This is the psychology of history.
That's right. I mean, the way we understand history is framed by the present. And that's why the challenge of being a historian is you just got to check onto a plane, leave the present, and go to the past and just think it's a total foreign country. It's got nothing to do with today. That's the line I give to my researchers, students. You know, they cannot go about studying the past so they understand how the present is different. They need to just go to the past and meet it on its own terms.
Jay Sexton, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
David, the pleasure was mine, and I hope everyone has a good bicentennial of the Monroe Doctrine.
Jay Sexton is Kinder Institute Chair in Constitutional Democracy and Professor of History at the University of Missouri, and author of the 2011 book, The Monroe Doctrine, Empire and Nation in 19th Century America. Listen to our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. One of the greatest festivals in the world, centering around one of the world's greatest natural wonders. This past weekend, Cambodians celebrated Bon Om Tuk, the water festival. Lots and lots of colorful boats racing up and down the Mekong and Tonle Sap rivers, putting on a show. The rainy season is over, and it's time to catch lots of fish. Cambodia's water festival has been 6 months in the making. Flashback to May, when those monsoon rains begin falling across the lower Mekong Basin. The lower Mekong normally flows south into the South China Sea. As rains reach their peak, the Mekong swells, slows down, and begins flowing north. In the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh, the lower Mekong joins the Bassac River, and their engorged waters split to the northeast, the upper Mekong continues up to Laos. To the northwest, the Tonle Sap River flows up to the Tonle Sap, Southeast Asia's largest inland lake. In the dry season, the Tonle Sap is shallow. Adjoining wetlands are prime fish spawning grounds. At the end of the rainy season, in November, those waters are 10 times deeper, and the lake begins flushing out. Down in Phnom Penh, it's time to catch and eat fish. Here's a story I produced a few years back. A crowded market in Phnom Penh. Tables burst with fish from Cambodia's great lake, the Tonle Sap. The Tonle Sap is one of Earth's great wonders. It's fed by the Mekong River, which swells with monsoon rains in May, slowly halts, and then starts to flow upstream, inflating the Great Lake into a vast floodplain. Fish spawn there in huge numbers. When the Mekong turns southwards again in the fall, almost a quarter of a million tons of fish hitch a ride in a headlong rush towards the South China Sea.
The Tonle Sap is the heart of Cambodia, the most productive lake in the world.
Lee Vuti is with Cambodia's Fisheries Administration.
Hello.
Hello.
He's taken me to Phniat Koponsat, a fishing community in the Great Lakes northern watershed. The village is a collection of tidy houses on stilts, many of them artfully decorated, shaded by a grove of trees on the edge of a quiet waterway.
You see the fish already? It's a prawn or not?
It's amazing.
Yeah? You see this very big fish.
This is a conservation pond, one of six set up by the community group that's responsible for running the local fishery. A few steps behind us, the leaders of Phniat Koponsat's Fishery Management Committee are gathering, casually dressed and sitting cross-legged on a deck overlooking the water. In the past, Tonle Sap fishing rights were auctioned off to the highest bidder. Businessmen and military officers were rewarded for their loyalty, and the government filled its coffers. In 2005, encouraged by foreign donors and NGOs, the Cambodian government redistributed over half of the Tonle Sap's commercial lots to communities around the Great Lake. Phniat Koponsat is one of these.
Before they fish, but they not fish freely. They have to hide, they have to steal. But when the government allow them, give to them, they feel like this belongs to them. They want to maintain this resource.
Phniat Koponsat's Fishery Management Committee has the right to draft local plans and rules that ensure equal access to fish while conserving fish stocks.
If they do not form a community fishery, it becomes anarchy. So nobody can control anyone. Anyone can fish and become a serious problem and can fight each other. And illegal fishing also happen, and the resource will be destroyed. That's why they said, okay, everyone have to respect this rule and regulation for this community.
Vuti and I walk down a rickety wharf and into a wooden dugout, a boat purchased with the support of Canada's International Development Research Center, the IDRC. The dugout settles deeply in the pond with barely a few inches to spare. We slice through calm channels shaded by leafy trees sticking out of the water. The flooded forest around us is the life of the fishery. When the Tonle Sap is at its highest, fish spawn among its tangled tree roots. When it recedes, they hide in deep pools the Great Lake leaves behind. There's plenty of fish to eat year-round.
If you talk about Cambodian people, you talk about fish. Even fish sauce is made of fish. So every meal, they eat fish. Everybody eat fish. They use hook long line now. They are fishing now. You can see two of them.
Here, outside the conservation area, people fish with nets and lines in the shade of the flooded forest. Fishing gear is often stolen, and poaching takes place too, in spite of community rules. So Fniat Koponsat's management committee created sanctuaries to protect the fish stocks.
Community fishery, they put some artificial reef for fish to hide, to protect also from the illegal fishing.
What sort of artificial reef?
They put like a branch of tree or something very local material.
Enforcing rules isn't easy. Cambodia's community fisheries law prohibits them from patrolling in the absence of a government officer, and there are few of these around. Nor can they carry weapons, so they use gentler persuasion.
They just go to the house, the one who commit, who do illegal fishing, and ask them to promise and sign a contract, do not do this again.
Local management at Fniat Koponsat has been such a big success, it's received an award from Cambodia's Prime Minister, Hun Sen. Hun Sen has reason to be pleased. 30 years after the overthrow of his former comrades, the Khmer Rouge, and 2 decades of ensuing conflict, the fact that villagers are able to catch fish in peace shows that stability has finally returned to rural Cambodia. Vuti and I part ways, and I grab a cab to the town of Siem Reap, beside the open waters of the Tonle Sap. Tourists come here to visit the renowned 12th century temples of Angkor Wat, just north of town. I see why the ancient Angkor built their temples here. The Great Lakes floodplain bursts with fertility, and her waters offer navigation routes in all directions. To this day, life here follows their ebb and flow.
The people, they move to the open lakeside in the November, December, because the water starts to down.
Chan Tong is a local fisheries officer in Siem Reap. He takes me to the most celebrated of the Tonle Sap's floating villages, Trong Nias. Many of Trong Nias's 5,000 residents live on houseboats, drifting back and forth with the lake's waters. Others move their homes to the water's edge on trucks along narrow causeways.
They move a few times per year by the level of water, so they spend a lot of money for their moving their house.
We walk down a wharf flanked by houses, some of them floating, others on stilts. Beneath the awning of a floating house, men play cards and billiards. Nearby, 3 ladies are sitting around a bucket of fish, cutting them into pieces, which they pound into prahok, traditional fish paste. Tong and I hop into a motorboat for a ride out onto the Tonle Sap. 10 minutes out, up and down in the wake of tourist boats crammed with foreigners, we pass a floating tourist center with an open-air restaurant. Tourists spend a lot of money here, but there's a little trickle-down to those who are preserving the main attraction.
I think that 90% of the budget from tourists in the middleman. But we will to create the community fishery association boat, yeah, to support tourist service.
Soon, the hubbub of tourists fades in the distance. Before us, beneath a hazy sky, lie the languid waters of the Great Lake, now at its highest, over 10,000 square kilometers of water, brimming with fish.
More than 200 species fish living in the Tonle Sap today. Yeah. 2 kinds of this species, the blackfish, it is not migrate far from their place, breeding, spawning in the one place. But about white fish migrate from the Mekong River to the Tonle Sap Lake. And when the water down, white fish migrate to the Mekong River and some migrate to the Tonle Basa.
Here and there, islands of forest poke through the water's surface.
It's the flooded forest, but now we can see only top of tree because the water come up.
stands like this are vanishing fast. Over half have been cut down to make way for upland rice production. The Cambodian government has drafted laws to protect the forest, with penalties of up to 5 years for illegal cutting. But the cutting goes on. So does overfishing, with large trawlers and long nets. The Tonle Sap's annual fish catch is reportedly going down.
The middlemen or rich men, they want to destroy the forest to do the dry rice farm. Yeah. They want to expand the farm to the big so that it has a problem to the flooded forest cover.
Here in the village of Presramok, the village chief sits with a cigarette in his hand, describing their fish conservation policy as well as any development expert.
You mentioned about the rich man, they never to think about sustainable or resources. But for the poor people, they think about they can get resources to use daily and today and tomorrow and after tomorrow.
Cambodia's Great Lake has sustained rich and poor alike for generations with more than just fish. It has helped Cambodians to mark the seasons, to remember and rejoice. At a Buddhist pagoda in Phnom Penh, near the junction of the Tonle Sap and Mekong rivers, people have come to honor their ancestors and make offerings of food. Tables have been covered with bowls of sticky rice from the Great Lake's fertile floodplain and fish from her submerged forests. A month from now, thousands will take to their boats for the annual water festival, bobbing up and down as the Great Lake's waters rush past Phnom Penh on their way to the South China Sea. The waters have flowed this way for millennia and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. The fate of their fisheries wealth is another matter. For more information about the Tonle Sap and Cambodia's Water Festival, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. For today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out, for now.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
The Bill Reid Gallery presents Bright Futures, an exhibition that brings together the innovative art of Bill Reid with new works by contemporary emerging and established Indigenous artists of the Northwest Coast until January 14, 2024. To celebrate the life of Bill Reid 25 years after his death, contributing artists were invited to ponder and critique the question, how is Bill Reid continuously inspiring contemporary Northwest Coast artists? To learn more about this exhibition, visit billreedgallery.ca.